Forecasters predict by Sunday afternoon, a significant weather event involving snow, sleet, and rain, and a lot of wind will begin battering the region all the way up to Boston. Currently in Washington, it's partly sunny and 45 degrees. In New York, it's sunny and 37. I'm Askia Muhammad. Thank you for listening to WPFW Washington and WBAI New York.
The previous program was Ecologic, and that is heard Fridays at 2:30 p.m. Stay tuned for Live on the Fly with Randy Credico, and this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online.
Okay, that was Anton Karas, the third man. I'm Randy Credico, Randy Credico Live on the Fly here on 99.5 FM in New York City, WBAI, WBAI.org. Give to WBAI. Well, I got this incredible show today. And before I get to it, I just want to mention on Friday the 21st, there will be a demonstration outside the DOJ in D.C., in support of Julian Assange. So if you want to attend that, please send me an email at credico2014@gmail.com. All right, so today, Friday, opening in New York City at the Film Forum on Houston Street and at AMC Lincoln Square is this cinematic masterpiece. It's called Who We Are, A Chronicle of Racism in America. And you've got to see this, folks. We have the three producers, the directors, the editor, and the subject and the writer of the documentary film. I don't really know what to call it because it's all of it, and I'm sure they'll clarify. But before we do that, I want to go to the trailer of Who We Are, A Chronicle of Racism in America, and we'll be right back.
We had been on a path toward racial justice that was amazing. There was the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. We were at a tipping point. We're 50 years later now. Once again, America is having to look at issues of race dead in the eye. And once again, we are at a tipping point. And the question for all of us in this room is, what are we going to do about it?
Well, walking and talking with my mind.
If I make the statement to you, America was founded on white supremacy.
I'm walking and talking with my mind.
You could say, Jeff, that's an extreme statement. And what I would say to you is, don't believe a word I say about it. All you have to do is go look.
Slavery had nothing to do with the war because they were treated as family.
I don't know if he can be reached, but if no one tries, he definitely won't change.
Lynchings took place in this very spot. Everybody needs to know what happened because it's a part of our history, American history.
America has demonstrated its greatness time and time again, and America is one of the most racist countries on the face of the earth. Those two things are not mutually exclusive. Virginia passed a law, an enslaved person's death while resisting a master is not a felony. Would you look at those words, please, and think about the videos you have seen in the past 10 years?
Shot fired!
It's still not a felony.
Sing hallelujah!
We want all Confederate memorabilia removed from our city.
We have to save other lives.
It's just too big of a story.
Hallelujah. And this is who we are in America.
Okay, that's a trailer from who we are. I'm Randy Critico, Randy Critico, live on the fly here on 99.5 FM in New York City, WBAI. The film is an off-center production. Sarah and Emily Kunstler are the producers and directors. Emily's the editor. And Jeffrey Robinson is a producer. He is the writer and the subject of this film, the documentary. And joining me today is music icon Roger Waters for the third straight week, who I consider the most productive and profound and versatile maker of music of my generation. Roger, I'm going to go to you first before I go to Jeffrey and Emily and Sarah. You've seen this film a couple of times. Give us your thoughts and overview.
Yeah, I have. I've seen it a couple of times. I saw it back in November when I sadly couldn't make the showing in New York with the Q&A after it. I'm sorry I missed that. So I'm really happy to meet Jeffrey, who I've seen him obviously a lot, and Emily and Sarah. And then I watched it again last night because I'm not an idiot, you know, and I thought you really should really watch it once more before we go on this program tomorrow. So I did, and I wrote a bunch of notes, which I just dashed out while you were playing the trailer. I dashed out into the other room to get them. I'm going to put them there just in case I need to refer to them. I learned quite a lot when I was watching the movie. What did I learn? One, I learned that this man is a teacher, a proper teacher. I mean, it's not a lecture, but the talk that he gives in the town hall, a building I know well from my career as a sort of itinerant bass player, and a beautiful room, I have to say. I love that room in New York or whatever, but is consummate in the apparent ease with which he delivers the narrative for this movie. So we should all take our hats off to Jeffrey, because it's an amazing performance, and it is a performance, and yet it's not really, because he's not an actor. He's not speaking words. He's on stage and he's being himself, and he's telling a story that is quite difficult to take for many of us, but is extremely necessary for all of us to hear. So hats off to the three filmmakers here who are in front of me today, because it is a remarkable piece of work. It is shocking and disgusting in the same measure that it is informative and deeply necessary. And when you hear some of the dates, and I won't be able to pull them all up now without referring to my notes, but the tree in the middle of the road and the last lynching or public lynching, your jaw drops to the ground. I read Thurgood Marshall's book a number of years ago, and all the way through I was just like that most of the time, because you go, 1960, this was happening in some county in Florida. You know, people were being bombed to death in the houses because they said the wrong thing in front of the sheriff or whatever it might be. So I'm really glad to come in. I'll stop now because I've been banging on, but I want to listen to what Jeffrey and Emily and Sarah have to say, and maybe I can chip in with a response a bit later.
You're going to be saying a lot. That was beautiful, by the way. I'm going to go to you first, Jeffrey. You were the legal director at the ACLU, criminal defense attorney, civil rights attorney. This project, which I saw in New Jersey when it was just a stage, in the early stages of it back in 2017, and I was there at Town Hall, that packed room, mesmerized. When did this, what's the genesis of this project?
Well, as is reflected in the movie, the genesis is really things that happened in my family that made me a parent of a 13-year-old young Taino Indian Puerto Rican and African American young man, and trying to wrestle with that experience and looking for help, really, in trying to figure out how to do it, I started reading things that shocked me. I was in my 50s. I've had one of the best educations in America, and I was hearing things I had never heard before. And that was very difficult for me to figure out. And in the process of finding things, I would find something else and find something else. And based on my training as a criminal defense lawyer, I knew that when you have a set of complicated facts, putting them in a timeline is sometimes helpful. And when I did that, things started to blow open. Like I was shocked. I had many of the feelings that Roger described having. And after I stopped blaming myself for being stupid and ignorant and lazy and not knowing this stuff, I figured, well, I'll blame my teachers. Why not blame them? And then I figured, how can they teach me something they weren't taught? And that was really the genesis of this, is feeling like, if I don't know this stuff, I'm willing to bet there are a whole lot of other Americans who don't know. And I want to find out how many they are. And that's how this started. And I just want to say before I end that, Roger, it's a pleasure to meet you in this meeting. And I owe you a great deal of thanks, because many of the words that you and your colleagues wrote, especially in the early 70s, gave voice to feelings that I had. And that's been an assist throughout my career. So thank you for your work.
Well, Roger, I just want to say this is really not only a great composer, but also a super activist. I call him an activist extraordinaire. He gets out there in the same manner that Dick Gregory or Pete Seeger or Harry Belafonte or Paul Robeson. It's a rare quality in the entertainment business to see someone do what Roger has done on just about every major issue. Now, Sarah and Emily, what brought you to this project, to Jeffrey, and when did you decide that we've got to make this into a movie?
Well, I heard Jeffrey speak, and he blew me away. I mean, you know, Randy, Emily and I were raised in an anti-racist family. We were raised in a family with a commitment to stand up and figure out a path forward that involved being committed to and fighting against racism. And despite that background and that commitment that I brought into the room where I heard Jeffrey talk, I knew so very little of what he shared. And it shocked me to the core, and it angered me, and it also shifted the frame for me. I couldn't look at the world the same way after hearing Jeffrey present this 400 years of history, from the 1600s to today, of an unbroken line of white supremacy and the legacy of slavery that persists to the present day. I hadn't seen it that way before, and I can't see it the same way anymore.
And you, Emily?
Well, then Sarah called me. And it's essentially, as she likes to say, said, "What are you going to do for the next? What are you doing for the next 5 years?" Or rather, "I know what you're doing for the next 5 years," because it's no short time frame, and it's no small undertaking to make a film. And then the next step was to sell the idea to Jeffrey, right? I mean, this we were so lucky to stumble on Jeffrey after he had done this 8 years of research. You know, he basically built the backbone of this film before we ever met him. So we arranged to have coffee near his ACLU office in downtown Manhattan. Jeff ordered a hot chocolate. Sarah and I both got lattes. and we sat there and told him we wanted to make a movie out of this. Through the process, we built trust with him, and he allowed us to come along with him on his journey.
Right. Go ahead, Jeffrey.
Well, Sarah and Emily contacted me, and I certainly knew the last name, and I knew the family and the legacy of their parents, but I needed to know them. And I talked to other criminal defense lawyers about Sarah, and that gave me a great deal of comfort. And I watched the film they made about their dad, and that gave me a great deal of comfort. And just talking with them about what I was trying to portray and how they could help do that in a much more powerful way. We built up a lot of trust with each other, and that's what I think makes this film so special. Many people are shocked to hear that, you know, I am the owner of the film and had final editorial say in making the film. But this is the way that Sarah and Emily came to me, saying, this is work that you've done. We want to try and help you get your message out. We want to make it as we want to make it better and as powerful as we can, but we're not looking to change it. And that kind of respect was incredibly important. And so it went very quickly from who has editorial control to what do we think and what do our colleagues think is the best way to make this movie. And when I saw the first rough cut of the film, I will throw it back to Sarah and Emily. Sarah said her jaw dropped when she heard me speak. My jaw dropped when I saw the first cut of this film because I had no idea what it could become beyond, you know, what for me in my mind was something that started as a PowerPoint presentation I was giving on a bedroom sheet to my neighbors.
Well, it's an incredible piece of work. I want to play a clip. This is called Our Constitution. It's actually half the clip that I have, but this is very germane to where we are right now. Kelly, could you set that up? This is a...
Article 4, Section 2, no freedom for a runaway because slaves have to be returned to owners on demand. And people have said that the folks who wrote our Constitution were brilliant, and I agree with that. They were brilliant, and they were sneaky, too, because they said, you know, somebody may try and amend the Constitution and get rid of Article 1, Section 9. So in Article 5, they said, you can't amend Article 1, Section 9 until 1808. This is how important the concept of white supremacy was to the people that founded the country. When they were talking about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, they saw that as being completely consistent with enslaving people.
All right, that's a clip from Who We Are. That was filmed at Town Hall back in 2018. Roger, you and I talked about this the other day when we were interviewing Craig Murray about the Founding Fathers. Why don't you riff on that that little pastiche there?
Riff?
Yes.
Oh, thanks, Randy. I always knew you were a friend, but I didn't know quite how...
All right, you could ask a question. It's okay. This is all extemporaneous.
Listen, it's you know, more things come up. As you know, I can only ever speak off the cuff because that's how I work. I'm not working, by the way. This is like leisure time for me. This is fun talking about this stuff. Why is it fun? And I'm sort of half serious about that. It's fun because it makes me think. And when something makes me think and feel at the same time, then that is... that's what I yearn for, and this does. So a number of things come up, and I'll just spout them out. The first two things that come up is, one is the image that plays constantly through the event in the theatre and through Emily and Sarah's work, which is the Sisyphus story, like the pushing of the rock up the hill and arriving at the tipping point and then it rolling back down to the bottom again, which is reiterated two or three times during the movie. And I love the fact that that happens because it's true, and not just the three times that in the movie it rolls back to the bottom, but the fact that at the end of the movie we get told we're there now, this is it now. Black Lives Matter is all those people in all those streets, in all those cities, not just in the United States, but all over the world, pushing that rock slowly, all those football players in the English Premier League taking a knee every Saturday before they were all pushing it up to the top of the thing. And there it is, teetering. And on the other side, of course, are the forces of evil. And what are they? There's a lot of talk about white imperialism through this thing. We just heard about it again and about imperialism and slavery and the connections between... I actually adopted a phrase in my work about a year ago. I saw it in some weird TV show, and I can't remember what it was now, but these two words were put together and they stuck in my brain. I've been using it. And the two words are primal and disdain. So at the root of the white supremacist thing is this idea of primal disdain, and it's so deeply ingrained in people who've been sold the idea that they're somehow superior to other people for one reason or another, whether it's class, color, creed, nationality, religion, whatever, it doesn't really matter, but this primal disdain. But the point I was wanting to make about Sisyphus and the story, pushing the rock the hardest the other way, is the profit motive. All right. Oh, no, there he goes again. He's going to start going all socialist on us and telling us that, yeah, I am. That's what, why do you think they bothered to put people on, human beings on ships and ship them across the Atlantic Ocean? For money, just for profit. There's nothing. It's actually, you don't have to feel superior to other people to use them in your machine to make money for you to put in your pocket to feather your nest. So when we're arriving at this tipping point now in this thing, it has to do with that as much as it has to do with anything else. It won't be until we accept the reality of that situation that's been there right from whenever it was, 1776. Right from the beginning of the whole Founding Father and how they wrote all the laws and why they wrote them. They wrote them so they could continue to feather their nests until now and beyond, unless Jeffrey and Emily and Sarah and you and me get that rock to the top and push it down the other side and see what happens. And see what happens when people go, oh, my goodness, I had no idea till I read Thurgood Marshall's book or saw this film or whatever. And oh my heaven, oh my, look at the connection staring you in the face. I mean, and mentioning no names, you suddenly say, oh, I'm beginning to understand why, after doing some research at the beginning of the 20th century, they decided to put Coca-Cola in 32-ounce bottles instead of 12-ounce bottles. Why? Because they could make more money. They're only selling water and poison and sugar, and it costs them absolutely F all to put it in the bottle. And so the thing is, how do you get people to drink it, you know, or to give you the money? You know, because it's worth nothing, everything they give you is profit. And they do that, and it's really, really bad for them. It makes them really overweight. You're killing them slowly to make money, to feather your nest. And then what do? You get your mate down the road who's a chemist to make insulin and sell it to them for $100 a shot instead of whatever it costs, which is about $5 probably. And let us not forget that in this great country, insulin costs 10 times what it costs anywhere else in the world because it's all about making profit for people. Now, the whole issue about slavery and how it changed, particularly with 13. I love that movie as well, by the way. That is a great documentary, 13, and we should all watch that as well. But the idea that the really important thing about the 13th Amendment was the phrase, save that he or she commit a crime. We can't have slavery. No man shall be involved in slavery or indentured labor. Save that. Oh, it's simple. You're a vagrant. Boom. Come and work for me for nothing. For the rest. Ably supported, as you point out in your movie, by Richard Nixon and Nancy. Let's not forget Nancy and the war. Just say no. Just
say no. Right.
Okay. And all of that. And we know, and extrapolated by Bill Clinton and three strikes and you're out and the whole thing and all the graphs about the prison document, you know, population and what that we sort of know about as well. But this is so much more interesting than Kim Kardashian's bum. Thank you, Jeff.
Well,
you take my point.
Yes.
How could we persuade our brothers and sisters in the working population of the United States of America that you and you and you and you, Randy, are telling their story. And is this a story that they want to go on and into the next generation and the next generation and the next generation? Or do they want to rise up and go, no, this is, and I know they do. You know how I know? I'm not really one of them. I'm one of the ones who got lucky, like Jeffrey talks about how lucky he was having his parents who were like, desperately wanted him to have an interesting life. I had a mother a bit like that. She was always banging on at me about how I had to get an education. Why? Because she had friends her age who didn't, and they ended up selling, you know, Hoovers or something door to door and were miserable most of their lives because they were, why would that be interesting? With all, you know, due respect to servicemen everywhere. And so there's something to be said for education, but this is what your film is, and it's such an important piece. And happily, you are not alone. I live out in the Hamptons, Bridgehampton, and there's a young woman here. I wish I could remember her name exactly. Sort of German, probably Jewish name, Celia Schrivener or Schrimbaschen or something. I can't remember, but I know that she started a petition and she got thousands and thousands and thousands of signatories demanding that the public school system in this area here, out in the Hamptons of all places, starts teaching American history to our children. And I only say our children because I pay taxes here, so they are all my children. Very little, very few pennies out of every dollar I pay in tax to the United States federal government trickles down, by the way, to the public school system, unfortunately. But nevertheless, I know once you press the button and wind me up, I'll go on forever.
All right, it's okay. I want to add, Emily, I saw you in an interview saying that if this, right now, the way things are, your film, you and Sarah's film, Jeffrey's film, most likely couldn't be shown in a lot of public schools or even the libraries in certain states. And that's why it's so important people see it in theaters. It's going nationwide next week. But so do you think your film would be knocked off in these states?
We definitely see going to see our film as a political act. And with these anti-CRT laws, you know, coming up state by state, it will become a crime to show our film in schools in certain places in this country, which is terrifying to think about, for sure. But you know, like Jeffrey says, and well, like I guess like we all say at different times, school isn't the only place to learn. So we're really hoping that people can come out to the theaters to start this education. But Jeffrey has also started the Who We Are project, and this film is only the first part of that project. But Jeffrey can talk about the goals of that project through education through different parts of the country and bringing this message to as many different groups as possible.
Yes, Jeffrey. You know, it's 2 hours long. I've seen it 5 or 6 times, and the thing is, like 2 hours. You want more at the end because you're only getting a small drop. I know the presentation, you covered a lot of other aspects of racism over the last 500, 600 years in America. And you had to pick and choose which way to go for this film. 2 hours long. So where do you go from here? Is this the first installment of Who We Are?
The Who We Are film is the first thing that the Who We Are project is producing. Until March 31st of last year, I was a deputy legal director at the ACLU in New York, and I quit that job to form the Who We Are project because I am convinced that a lack of information, a lack of knowledge about our true history is one of the foundational problems in moving forward movements about racial justice, in doing policy about racial justice, because without this knowledge, we end up coming up with solutions that absolutely will not work because they don't address the root problem. And if you don't know the root problem, you're simply clipping at the edges of the weeds and they will come back even stronger. So I felt like there was one of the things that Roger and his friends said in the 70s. You've been in the pipeline filling in time provided with toys and scouting for boys. It's really easy just to like let yourself fit into this way that the world is working. And I have felt that discomfort. I have felt it when my nephew became my son and came to live with me after 3.5 decades as a criminal defense lawyer working on issues of racial justice. I felt like it wasn't enough. And that's why I went to the ACLU. And there I was in charge of their work in the criminal legal system and on racial justice. And that work is critically important. But I left that work for two reasons. Number one, because they have young leaders there who are ready to carry on with that very important work. And number two, because I saw a gap in the discourse about how we figure out who we actually are and how we get to who we want to be. And that gap was in people confronting our history. George Orwell said, who controls the past controls the future. And if you erase, just to take, you know, there's been a lot of stuff about housing and subprime mortgages and things like that that have been in the news lately. White Americans, 75% of those families own their homes. For Black Americans, it's under 50%. Why is that? Jared Kushner would tell you that's because Black people just don't want to be successful enough. We haven't worked hard enough, and if we would just work harder, things would be better. And if you go to the history to say, well, is Jared Kushner right? If you erase redlining, if you erase the policies of the Federal Housing Authority, if you erase what happened in the subprime mortgage horror, then you could look at it and say, well, maybe it is Black people's problem and they should just figure it out. That's what erasing our history does. It lets a false narrative thrive. And so I'm constantly reminding myself that when you are coming after someone's origin story, that's a heavy, heavy thing. And it's going to be met with resistance, and you're going to have to keep pushing because people don't want to give up the origin story, the story that tells us that America is about freedom and liberty and everybody getting what they deserve. And that origin story doesn't set up with the facts.
We are talking with Jeffrey Robinson. My co-host is Roger Waters, also the producer and director of the film, Emily Kunstler, an editor, and Sarah Kunstler, a producer and co-director. What I'd like to do right now is play another clip from the film. It's called Who We Are, by the way, Chronicle Racism in America, and it opens today in film form on Houston Street and at AMC Lincoln Square, and Emily, Sarah, and Jeffrey will be there for the 4:30 showing and the 7:30 showing today for a Q&A session. At Film Forum, they will have a recorded Q&A prior to, and this will be Friday and Saturday. And so I want everybody to get a ticket, go down there and watch this. And if you can't make it, buy a ticket anyway, because we need as many people to show their support for this film, Who We Are. This is a clip. This is called Fingerprints, and we'll be right back, and we'll get Roger Waters' comments on this little clip.
What are the three holes that I see in these bricks in the walls there?
They're fingerprints. Enslaved people would begin to learn a skill at the age of about six. Mm-hmm. And so fingerprints and handprints and thumbprints exist all throughout the city because enslaved people build the city. And so on churches, on businesses, in alleyways, you see these in theaters, you see these all throughout the city in very, very subtle ways. And if you don't know what you're looking for, you may not see them.
But they're there.
Absolutely. And they are a way of the enslaved who created this city and created the economy that created this country to remind us, hey, I was here too.
Okay, before I go to you, Roger, Emily and Sarah, when you were down there for the filming of this, it was Charleston, South Carolina, right, Jeffrey?
Yes.
Right. Did you know that history? Were you shocked when you ran across this information? I'll ask you, Sarah. We haven't heard from you in a second.
We did not know about the fingerprints of enslaved people who built Charleston were visible in the bricks of the city. Part of the amazing experience of making this film was realizing moments like that, realizing how much of our history is hiding in plain sight, like those fingerprints on the bricks, like the hanging tree in Charleston, South Carolina, like the stairways to nowhere in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to the platforms where the houses were never rebuilt. Even the history of the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and what that symbolizes to people who drive over it every day and see that name, right?
Or the site of the auction block in downtown Manhattan.
Yeah.
So, this history is out there waiting for us to find it and reckon with it. And that, that is the important message of Jeffrey's talk. We hope it's the message of this film that this history is out there for all of us, that learning this country's true history is a radical political act, and that it's up to all of us to go after it.
I just say real quick?
Yeah.
Especially with this last clip, when Roger was talking about the economics of oppression, I'll kind of just call it that in a general sense. When you see how much of that city was built by the labor of enslaved people, when you understand that one of the things the South was really angry about were things called moral, M-O-R-R-I-L, tariffs, which were tariffs on the crops that enslaved people were producing for their quote-unquote owners. We're talking about money. And in the state of Mississippi's secession statement, there is a sentence that I think sums it up as clearly as possible. They say, either we give up property worth $4 billion in money, or we secede. And you know what they did? They seceded because they weren't about to give up $4 billion in 1861. So the role that money has played in many examinations of history, this link of follow the money, is one of the ways that you can begin to understand both motivation and the action on that motivation.
Right. By the way, that hanging tree in Charleston was a scene of, in 1822, Gabriel Prosser's rebellion, which didn't actually come into fruition. It was just planned, and like 40 or 50 of his associates were hanged at that tree, I believe. Roger, your visceral response looking at that clip.
Well, I was hearing it because I watched the movie last night, for God's sake. I don't have to keep watching these clips. It's right, it's there in my frontal lobe. I'm not a bloody field mouse. I can remember things for like an hour or two. Anyway, what I was doing while you were doing that was checking on this story, which absolutely has to do with exactly what you're talking about. And now I'm going to name this woman now. Oh, it's gone back. Her name is Cecilia Scheuer, S-C-H-E-U-E-R. And she is the youngish, I think, woman in Southampton Public School District who started the petition. And I just want Southampton Union Free School District, 7,500 signatures they're looking for. They're up to 5,000. This was like a year or two ago. So whether she ever got there, Shoya started this petition. Hang on, there's something here. It's in her statement here. Implement a culturally relevant, this is item one in her demands, relevant curriculum, which includes a mandatory racial studies class as a graduation requirement. The class should be taught by one black faculty member and one white faculty member, so as to put different lived experience in direct conversation with each other and guide students on how appropriately to do so, understanding and engaging in self-reflection. And it goes on for paragraph after paragraph about learning history of the United States of America. And Cecilia, I've outed you now. You'll never be able to go to the tennis club again. You know, whatever that bloody club is called with all those grass courts down the end of First Neck Lane. Anyway, I know what it's called. I just can't remember at the moment. But I admire this woman. I've never met her. She grew up here. I've seen photographs of her with a tennis racket or whatever. And I'm thinking, this is, you know, this movie, when I was 9 years old, which is when Ivanhoe came out in the cinemas. Speaking of films, now that was a film, Ivanhoe. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I've forgotten who was in it. Probably Richard Todd, someone like that. We were given the day of school one day. And where did we go? We went to the cinema. Why? Because they showed the coronation and the climbing of Everest. Well, in my view, they should show this film on a national holiday one. What about Martin Luther King Day? All schools closed, everybody goes to the cinema, and they show this film, your film, Emily and Sarah and Jeffrey. And Cecilia Shower, she will be there in Southampton shepherding all the children into the cinema. We'll sit them all down in rows and go, there you are, watch this. And then we'll go back to school and we'll talk about it.
Right.
And you will all go, my dad said, I mean, I'm sorry to do a weird accent, but, you know, but this kid's dad was probably one of those driving in a pickup truck with a Confederate flag flying off the back and big signs that went Trump 2020 on it, and it'll happen again in 2024, and they may win. And that is why I want to divert this conversation very slightly to how do we get this film in front of people, and how do we fight the insidious nature of the lawfare that is going on for... Another of my pet peeves, or not peeves, but my bits of activism is about BDS, which is fighting for Palestinian rights. And they're in 22 states in this union, local government is putting laws through state legislature to outlaw the boycott of the state of Israel, which, as we all know, is racist and apartheid. And a perfectly legitimate target, in my view, obviously, because I'm on that side of the argument, for boycott. But whatever side you are of the argument, boycott should just be, yep, that's okay. No, we signed on that, off on that 200 years ago. It's something that is absolutely nailed into our consciousness as free colonists in the United States. But is it? No, it isn't. That vote came out yesterday in Texas, some GOP legislature of some kind, and started arguing that they should make a law that said if you're talking about the Third Reich, you must be impartial. Yeah. What? What? Are you insane? What? Really? I mean, how crazy is that? And yet it's there, and he may well get that law passed the Texas state legislature to the eternal shame, not just of Texas and all those cows, but of all of us. You know, it's absolutely, we're all grinning and laughing like lunatics, because it's funny. It's hysterically funny, but it's not really funny at all. And it's no funnier than trying to illegalize using boycott as a tool of nonviolent protest. What is going on in this country? What is going on is that we are being taken over by Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos and a few other oligarchs and idiots like Donald Trump and whoever it might be. Anybody who supports the idea that it's okay to enslave people if you say they've committed a crime. That's why there are millions and millions and millions of black men in, and white, some white men as well, in prisons all over the United States, working for them to feather their nests and fill their pockets. And it's all done on the basis of the fact that actually after the Civil War, they did not deal with civil rights. They did not deal with looking at the whole idea that one group of people, i.e. white landowners, are legitimately using the idea of primal disdain to enslave and economically use fellow human beings, working them to their death, generation after generation after generation after, denying them any sense of any human right at all. And so should we be looking at this like your film, you three guys? Absolutely we should, because if not, we're faced with another 100 years or however long this small, fragile, flimsy planet lasts in the hands of these, because they are killing us all. They are killing us as sure as eggs is eggs. I know I'm drifting off the subject.
It is a very difficult time right now because we see so much happening, and you see January 6th, and you see people screaming at school board meetings. And I hate to do this, Roger, but I told you that, you know, some of the things that you and your colleagues wrote just resonated with me. If you didn't care what happened to me, and I didn't care what happened to you, then we would zigzag our way through the boredom and pain, occasionally glancing up through the rain, wondering which of the buggers to blame, and watching for pigs on a wing. This is what is it is a metaphor for the almost dystopia that we see and feel about the American experience right now. There's the pandemic and so many things of concern. And so much of it is because we have separated from each other. And part of that separation has to do literally with defining who we are and being able to accept. As a criminal defense lawyer, I don't expect America to be perfect. I have represented people my entire adult career who were wonderful individuals who also did really bad things. People aren't just one thing, and countries aren't just one thing. And so America has a history of greatness, and it has this history of horror. And those two things live together. And for people who want to focus only on the history of greatness and ignore the horror because that's somehow making us feel guilty or somehow it's dividing us, it once again comes back to the importance of the past, because without it, we are going forward almost into a vacuum where we will, for certain, repeat the same mistakes. Having said that, I think one of the reasons that I was so happy with what Sarah and Emily were able to do with this talk and to do with the film is, you know, we are not trying to be angry at anybody. What we're trying to say is, wherever you come from, whether you're white or black, and this is a collaboration between two white women and a black man, and this is about a history that's stolen from all of us. And if all of us can regain it, then we can sit at a table and have conversations about the future that are different. If we're talking about, for example, H.R. 40, the bill for reparations for slavery and the vestiges of slavery, We can talk about that in a vacuum. That's crazy. It would never work. You can't do that. Well, do you realize that we've already done it? We did it for Japanese Americans who were imprisoned for 3.5 years during World War II, and we paid $1.6 billion in reparations. Didn't come close to making the Japanese Americans whole for what they lost, but it was an important action by the government. Abraham Lincoln paid $1 million in 1862 money to white slave owners before the Emancipation Proclamation. So we have paid reparations for slavery. We just paid it to slave owners. And if we're going to talk about H.R. 40, which would establish a commission to do a study and then make recommendations to Congress, if we're going to talk about that in isolation, it sounds like a huge deal. We can't do that. But if we have our history, we know that we've already done it before, and we've done it on the wrong side of this issue. And I think that is the kind of history that will lead a person who says we can't have H.R. 40 to go, huh, well, I didn't know that. Wait a minute. Maybe this is something that we have to talk about. And it's at that moment that the ball at the top of Sisyphus's hill starts getting pushed just a little bit in the different direction.
That's true. I'm just going to say something, Randy, because Sisyphus's ball rolling down the other hill. Once it starts rolling down the other hill, though, its progress cannot be impeded by us clinging to ideas that some of us animals are more equal than others. It's absolutely fundamentally necessary for the ball to roll down the other side of the hill that we throw that away as bullshit. And I know that Emily and Sarah and Jeffrey are quite right, that this is something that is clung to deep in the DNA of millions, millions and millions of people, not just who live in this country, but European stock all over the world. The whole settler colonialist experiment all over the world sort of is stuck with this thing, and it's killing them. Look, there was something else sort of more important that I wanted to say about that, but I can't say it now because I have to say to Jeffrey, I love the fact that he can quote my lyrics, but I have to say, Jeffrey, you kept saying you and your friends, you and your colleagues, you know, you and your colleagues did this stuff, but no, he didn't. I did it. It's nothing to do with David Gilmore or Nick Mason or Rick Wright. That's my feelings. That's why I do what I do today and they do whatever they do, you know.
Right.
Well, one of them's dead, bless him. You know, Rick is no longer with us. And Nick collects cars and blah, blah, blah. And David, I've no idea. We don't have much to do with it. David did his damnedest all those years to stop me doing that work. That's why left. Right, I finished that speech. Let's talk about Sisyphus again and the ball rolling down there. I just think there'll be one or two people watching that will go, did you hear what you just said? Well, maybe. I forgot. I've lost my track now. You see, you've stirred me up and you've pushed me down a different... But I am listening to you about HR, whatever the bill is. Oh, I know what I was going to say. I'm involved locally here with the Shinnecock Nation. And I promise you that don't tell any of my neighbours. But the end of the work that I'm doing with really close friends that I've got in the Shinnecock Nation, particularly in the Graves Protection end of the operation, and also a wonderful man here who runs something called the Peconic Land Trust, we talk about, and I talk to young lawyers at the Nation, we talk about exactly what you're talking about, because it does apply to Native Americans as well as to the enslaved people who were brought over from Africa during those hundreds of years. And although I, in my lifetime, don't expect to see anything happen really much, things slowly are beginning to change, even on that issue, mm-hmm. You know. Oh, my God, did we really do that? Is that who we are? Is that what we did? Because that's the other big, can't go there, not going to have that conversation. No, absolutely not. You can put anything in the school curriculum, but you cannot put the genocide of the Native American people in there. It's not happening. Or slavery. Boom, finish. We'll talk about Carnegie and how many railroad tracks he laid till the cows come home. That's what we want to talk about, and how brilliant we are, and how insulin costs 10 times as much here as it does anywhere. Oh, no, sorry. Oh, I forgot, you know, not allowed to talk about that. But I know I'm joking about what we are and aren't allowed to talk about, but it's hugely important in any conversation that we have about educating ourselves about our history, because it is all of us. It's all of our history, and we cannot proceed without knowing it. You're right. You're so right, you guys.
All right. We're going to take a don't go anywhere. Everybody good? We want to take a short break here and say goodbye to our New York listeners and come back and finish this discussion and show another clip. Don't go anywhere, anybody. This is Sam Cooke, Chain Gang, and we'll be right back, and we'll finish up.
Well, don't you know? That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. All day long they work so hard till the sun is going down. Working on the highways and byways and wearing a frown. You hear them moaning their lives away. Then you hear somebody say, that's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. Can't you hear them?
WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Bangert Drowns with some brief news headlines. Student loan company Navient agreed to cancel $1.7 billion in debt for nearly 66,000 borrowers in a deal to settle legal claims that it engaged in predatory lending behavior. That deal, reached with 39 states, also requires the company to pay $95 million in restitution. Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro, who helped sue Navient, said the company, quote, targeted students who it knew would struggle to pay loans back, end quote. Navient marketed its loans as filling the gaps left by other lending, but, according to the company's own records, were a baited hook to draw in more federally backed loans. In a statement, the company did not admit fault in the settlement and said the suit was, quote, based on unfounded claims. The settlement marks the end of a major portion of legal action against the company, which began 5 years ago. Michigan's attorney general is asking federal prosecutors to investigate 16 Republicans who allegedly submitted falsified documents claiming to be presidential electors from the state, despite Democrat Joe Biden's victory in Michigan. AG Dana Nessel said her office had been contemplating charges for nearly a year, but decided instead to pass the case to Western Michigan's U.S. attorney. Nessel told MSNBC's Rachel Maddow that GOP state parties engaged in a, quote, coordinated effort to submit so-called alternative slates of electors with fake documents. Quote, obviously, this is part of a much bigger conspiracy, Nessel said. The U.S. Attorney's Office has not commented on the case, nor has the Michigan GOP. Yesterday, the Republican National Committee threatened to bar GOP candidates from election year debates in a letter sent by Chair Ronna McDaniel to the Nonpartisan Commission on Presidential Debates. GOP concerns echo complaints made by former President Donald Trump, who repeatedly accused the commission of unfair treatment. New York Times reporter Maggie Haberman, who initially broke the story, suggested the RNC's threat is a preemptive measure and an indicator that former President Trump is set to run again in 2024. Earth's average surface temperature in 2021 reached its sixth highest level since reliable temperature record keeping began in 1880, according to new reports from NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Temperatures last year were nearly 2 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than average temperatures in the late 19th century. 8 of the top 10 warmest years on our planet occurred in the last decade. NASA Administrator Bill Nelson called the warming trend an indisputable fact that underscores the need for bold action to safeguard the future of our country and all of humanity. Quote, science leaves no room for doubt. Climate change is the existential threat of our time. End quote. And the Earth's oceans